welcome to episode 90 of Tabletop Game Talk, a show where we talk about all types of topics in tabletop gaming. I'm one of your hosts, Josh.
I'm Chris.
And I'm Kitty.
Today, we're talking about the iconography and components found in games and how that can affect, in a good or bad way, the overall enjoyment of the game. But first, a thank you to our Patreon friends of the show, Emil Jiljam, George Gia, Adam Harrison, and Corey Bell. And thank you to our newest patrons, Eric Silander, Adam Kribles, and Mike Smith. I hope I didn't butcher any names. Also, a huge thank you to all of our other patrons as well.
I think you might have got that last one wrong. Mike Smith, that's a hard one. But
it is tough.
Welcome. Yeah. Welcome back, Mike. Mike left us for a little while, but he promised he'd be back, and that's normally what you say when you do a breakup and you don't ever plan to see each other again. But he really did come back. Thanks, Mike.
Here he is.
So, some announcements. Let's see. This weekend, I will be in Atlanta at CMON Expo. I'm looking forward to that. That's going to be fun. If you're there, let me know. If not, I'll let you know how it was. Gen Con is a long way away. We're going to be there. We have a show on Friday at 5 at Gen Con. That's all I'll say about that for now. We have a new giveaway, Seventh Continent. So this one is a two-part giveaway. You're going to get the first base box now, and then you'll get the expansion content when they wave to ship it. This is pretty much the only way I know of to get this right now is through me. You probably could get it through other places too, but it's a Kickstarter-only game. So I got two copies because I knew I wanted to give one away. If you want to enter to win Seventh Continent, you can enter by emailing us at giveaway@tabletopgametalk.com. Put the subject "May Giveaway" and put your name and country of origin. If you're outside of the U.S., let me know that you're willing to pay for shipping and I'll happily enter you in. But it's probably, for this particular box, it'll probably be about $60 or $70 to most places outside of the U.S.
And you know, I seem to remember you raving about this one, so I think people should be very excited about it.
This is going to be one of the hot games of the year for sure. It is a great solo game. It's a great co-op game. It's an adventure game. It's a story game. It's the type of game that doesn't play in a normal amount of time. You're not going to be done in an hour and a half, maybe 12 to 15 hours for the first one. But it has this whole saving and resuming mechanic. There's a lot of cool things about Seventh Continent. So yes,
it's a game you started playing without us.
Well, in my defense, that's our next announcement. We all moved. Moved or are moving. So we used to live within... Yeah. We used to all live in the same building. I think when we first started, we were all in the same building. And then Josh moved down the street. So that was close enough. And then I moved an hour north, but I kept driving in. And now, Kitty, you're moving an hour west. And Josh, you're moving basically an hour south. So we're moving about as far away from each other as we can get and still be in the Chicago area.
I'm moving west and Josh is moving south, but I think I'm still going to be south of Josh.
Yeah. Yes.
Because south in the city is only a few miles, but it might as well be an hour. Cause I think that's how long it would take you to get from where you're at now to where you'll also be in the city. So we're working on this remote recording things. Bear with us while we're working out any technical difficulties. We're having a lot of fun kind of playing around with it. But yeah, so that's our next announcement. My next announcement that has nothing to do with moving is we're going to do another Kickstarter episode in the near future. If not the week after next, the week after that one. So we did an episode on Kickstarter way back. I think it was in the 20s. It was like 60 some episodes ago. A lot changes in a year and a half. So I want to do another episode on Kickstarter. And what I'm doing is I would love to get questions about Kickstarter. Pretty much anything you can think of. If you've never done Kickstarter, let me know. It's like, well, what should I expect? How do I get into it? Basically anything you want to know. Obviously I'm a little into Kickstarter, so I'm happy to give my opinion, and I don't want to say advice per se, but advice or however, whatever you want to call it. But I want to just get some questions. I have some things I want to talk about as well, and then Josh and Kitty will, and we're going to change up some stuff about Kickstarter, our Kickstarter segment in the near future. So this will all be kind of part of that. So get involved. And then my last announcement is not really an announcement as much as it's a news item. Have you guys heard of the retheming of Scythe called My Little Scythe?
No.
Oh, no. So this was someone, well, someone's daughter actually said, you know, I think this game Scythe is cool. I think it should have a My Little Pony theme. So her daughter, well, her dad and her daughter, the daughter of the dad, got together and rethemed Scythe into a My Little Pony game. And Jamie from Stonemaier Games, it's Jamie Stegmaier from Stonemaier Games. Yeah, it's very confusing. Picked it up and said, you know something? Yeah, we're going to really do this. So obviously they dropped the My Little Pony aspect of it, but they kept the name. So now you can get My Little Scythe, which is a kind of fuzzy animal themed Scythe officially published by Stonemaier Games.
That's incredible.
That's awesome.
Yeah. So if you have kids and you like Scythe, and this is definitely one worth taking a look at. All right, let's go to Kickstarters. First one, there's a new segment in Kickstarter. So this is usually not a segment, but there's been a cancellation of Kickstarters. So Dobbers, Quest for the Key, which I actually interviewed for last week or week before that, he's canceled that Kickstarter and he's going to restart it later this month, this month being May. So at the end of May, he's going to restart it. Basically, what happened is he didn't have a lot of publicity at the beginning. The progression wasn't as good. He knew that there were better things that he could do to make the Kickstarter campaign more successful. So instead of having a Kickstarter that didn't really meet expectations, he wasn't going to be able to hit the stretch goals he wanted to do, he's going back, reworking it, and he's going to relaunch it later this month. I will let you know when that is. And like I say, I'm most likely going to be backing this one. I think it looks really cool, and I'm excited to see what changes he makes. So I'll keep you up to date on there. But if you've heard about Dobbers and you're looking it up on Kickstarter, that's essentially what happened. It'll be back in a couple of weeks. So this week I backed two Kickstarters because I'm still following with an expansion isn't a Kickstarter rule. But the first one I backed was not
rules.
I like breaking rules. And I know I asked Sydney, I'm like, okay, I'm going to back this. It's an expansion. I'm going to back this other game too. It's not an expansion. And she's like, that's two Kickstarters. You shouldn't break that rule. I'm like, no. It's not broken. It's just a modification to the original contract. So
it's only eventually.
Eventually she gave in. So first, the non-Kickstarter one is Grawl. Grawl is they're marketing it as like a better werewolf. It's a different kind of werewolf. Werewolf being the social deduction game. Someone's a werewolf, you know, find that person. This one is a card game where everyone is a werewolf or a human. And the wolf's goal is to turn all of the humans into werewolves. The humans, they just have to have at least one human live. And you draw a card, you can give bites to people, you can give wounds to people, you can give, you know, there's counters to bites and wounds. And at certain points at nighttime phases, which are randomly determined by drawing a card, you're going to pass a card left and right, and then those get shuffled. And so they don't know who gave them what card, but you could get bit. If you get bit, you turn into a werewolf. And that's sort of the idea of the game. It looks really cool. It plays in 10 to 15 minutes, and it's kind of a more mechanical werewolf. So it kind of takes out that social accusation mechanic, but it still has it in there enough where it keeps a lot of social interaction. So this one,
I like the idea of this. You know, I think it will be, you know, kind of something new and gets some of that tension out of the way. Like I really like werewolf, but I'd be interested in this one and see how it plays out.
Yeah, I think it's going to appeal to a little bit.
Does it look that different from Witch Hunt? Because I know it, honestly, when you guys are describing it, it sounds a lot like the way you guys described Witch Hunt to me. So am I just not getting the subtleties of the difference, or are they similar but in different ways?
So Witch Hunt is basically the same every mechanic as werewolf. The only difference with Witch Hunt is you also get a roll card, and there's a mechanic where once you are voted out of the circle, you have a little bit of participation on the outside. So it plays just like werewolf. This one plays much more like a card game where you're trying to not get three of a kind Well, try not to get something that says three bites in your hand. If you get three bites in your hand and you're a human, you are turned into a werewolf, and the werewolves are one step closer to winning. So this is a far more mechanical thing. So you're drawing a card, you're looking at it, and like, all right, I just drew a bite. I think Josh is a werewolf, so I'm going to give Josh this bite card because that is going to not turn other humans into werewolves. But now, if I'm sitting next to Josh, I know that Josh has a bite card, and at night, he could pass it to me, so I can kind of confirm whether or not he's passing me a bite card or not, because only werewolves are allowed to bite at night. Humans can't get rid of their bites no matter what. So it's that kind of mechanic where you know what was put into people's hands. It's just, what do they still have in their hand as you go through the game rounds, if that makes sense.
Huh. I guess.
So I think it looks cool. And the base game is only $16. You can get the deluxe version for $24. And they just passed their $100,000 goal, which means that everybody who kickstarts the game will get a golden ticket. They're calling it a golden ticket, which gives you the ability to give a copy of the game for free to someone else. So you can just give that golden ticket is worth another copy of the game. So they're trying to really, and I mean, the whole Kickstarter campaign started out with giving away 500 copies at $1 a piece. It's like they're nice. Really trying to get this out there. So I think it looks pretty cool. I'm rooting for them. They're at 140,000 right now, and this is before their, you know, last 2 days surge. There's like 4 days left in it. This will end, well, 4 days as we record, but it ends May 10th, which I believe is a Wednesday, maybe the day after this drops. So check it out. It looks really cool. The other game is the Ancient Allies expansion to the City of Kings. Now, the City of Kings is a Kickstarter that I just received a couple weeks ago. It's this huge... Actually, I got the deluxe version, so it came in a smaller box, and then that box was inside a bigger box that looked identical. So when you unpacked the smaller box, you had a bigger box to put it in. But City of Kings is... I believe this is also Kickstarter exclusive. I've not seen it anywhere in retail, but it could be. They are re-releasing or re-kickstarting the deluxe version of City of Kings. But with Kickstarter, you can't just reprint the same thing again. So they added a whole bunch of expansion content. And the expansion content is what I got here. So this is some extra storylines, some extra monsters, some extra characters, just more stuff. And for the expansion material, if you just have that, if you already have the base and you want the expansion material, it's only $68. Only if you want the base game. Yeah, so you can get the deluxe base game for $129, or you can get both the expansions and the base game for $196, which is a little bit of a discount there. Not too much, but a little bit. So if City of Kings is something you're interested in, this is it is a 1-4 player co-op that where you're trying to get through these different adventures. At least I think it's a co-op. I'm going to do a full review next week on this one and play it a little bit more. You have until May 17th to back it, and hopefully I'll have the review up, well, on the podcast next week to kind of give you more information as to what this is. But there's plenty of reviews and playthroughs out there. Tom Vassell did a review on the Dice Tower. He's not crazy about the game. He wanted to be a little bit more flavorful, like more immersive into the world. As far as a Euro style adventure game, this is pretty cool. It's that kind of Euro style puzzly adventure story game with role playing game elements, dynamic monster. So there's a lot of cool stuff here, but it does feel more like a Euro game than it does an adventure game. So that is City of Kings. And yeah, I need to get you guys to play this with me probably. I think you would like it.
Oh, yeah, I'm down.
All right, watching a couple games. This week was kind of tricky. There's a lot out there, but nothing that was really calling my attention all that much. But these two are on the top of the list, and sort of. The first one's called EXO. Mankind. Yeah, I know, right? This is like a great... promotion. I don't promote these things. I'm just looking at them. I think if they're interesting or not. So EXO is this Mankind Reborn. Basically, it's a post-cataclysmic world where you're trying to run around in the world with an animal pet. So there's like a bear and a bird and a tiger and a koala. And it's you and your animal pet. You're working with everyone else. So it's a 1-4 co-op. and you're collecting resources, you're fighting off insects, and you're trying to complete some goal. And the goal can vary. It's whatever it happens to be for that particular scenario that you're playing through. The game ends when you have, you know, you're being overridden by giant insects, apparently. And anytime there's more than three, well, anytime there's three insects in the same zone, you've been overridden and you lose. Or if any of your characters dies, then the game immediately ends. But if you achieve the goal, then you win. So I'm not making it sound great, and I don't know how to make it sound great, but the game actually looks really cool. And that's my fault, not its, I guess. I will say it's it's a tricky one. It's made 150K out of a 60K goal. It has 16 days left as we record, so it ends on May 23rd. And there's only one price tag. It's $95 for the base game, and that's it. So there are some additional add-ons you can get, which adds more insect miniatures, and there's another like survivor characters and stuff like that you can get. All of it are optional, none of the stuff that you would need, but it does look interesting. So if you are looking for a co-op that exists in a post-cataclysmic world, check out EXO. That's EXO, Mankind Reborn. And then the other one, this one actually is more interesting. It wasn't until I started digging into it a little bit more, and I had a couple of people kind of throw this one on my radar. This is Court of the Dead, subtitled Mourner's Call. It is a 2-5 player semi-co-op in that there's only one winner, but everyone can lose together. You are trying to make friends with factions of the underworld, but you're trying to do it in a way that the Celestials don't notice that you're causing any kind of mayhem. And there's some really interesting mechanics here. Now, it seems like they're just like any old mechanic they could think of they wanted to throw in there. So there's area majority. So if you have the most factions or most faction control in a particular place, you get some bonuses to it. There's three different factions that you're trying to gain favor with, and you'll have one that you really want. There's hidden goals. There's this I split you choose mechanic for currency. So at the beginning of each round, you're going to roll four dice to see how many immortal souls come into the underworld, and then you're going to split them up. So one person splits them into a number of groups equal to the number of players plus one, and then everyone else is choosing piles. And whatever's left over goes into this middle ground, which we'll get to in a second, because then you'd go into a card drafting thing where you're drafting your cards for that particular action. Then you're playing those actions. At the end, there's a certain amount of tithing that you have to play to the heaven and hell deities. And the way that works is this blind, not really blind bidding, but blind donating. So it's like, okay, well, they're going to need 15 souls. And everybody is going to say, okay, I'm going to put a certain number of souls in, and then you all reveal. And if you hit the 15, then great. The person who put the most souls in, they get 3 victory points. Everyone else who put souls in gets 1 victory point. And if you didn't put any souls in, you're going to lose points. However, if you didn't meet the goal, then all, well, hell, I guess, breaks loose. And there's a lot of like different things that happen. And if you didn't put anything in, you lose a lot of points. But maybe you don't want to put anything in because if you think it's going to succeed, you don't mind losing a point or two because you're going to have more souls for the next round or something like that. So there seems to be a lot of this kind of blind bluff, choosing. In the end, it's a victory point game. You're trying to get the most points. But there seems like there's some pretty interesting mechanics here. So this is Court of the Dead. It goes until May 18th. Let's see. There's only a single tier. It's $90. There is no extra add-ons. They're at 245 plus of the 75K they needed with another 10 or 12 days to go. So this ends, again, May 18th. Okay.
I think you should get this one.
It does look really cool.
It sounds awesome.
Yeah, it's on the top of my list. So the game I'm going to review, this is a game I probably should have played before I backed the expansions last week or the week before, which was the Crisis expansion. Now, it was only a $9 expansion. So I'm like, okay, I just bought the expansion. I've had this game sitting on my shelf for almost a year. I should play it. So I did. And I played the solo version of it. And I have to say, I really, really, really like this game a lot. you're in another, it's not post-cataclysmic, but you're in a city, a futuristic city of sorts, but you wouldn't know it anything short of the art. It could be any city that's falling into disarray. And you are playing a corporation trying to do well in the city, but at the same time, make sure the city does well enough where it just doesn't go bankrupt and then everything's lost. So it's another one of those semi-co-ops where everyone can lose, but only one person's going to win. And I played this solo, and it plays the exact same way solo as it does with any number of players. The way you do this is you have a goal card. So you pick the number of players and you pick a difficulty, and you have to get to a certain number of victory points in order for the city to not get worse. But if you're playing multiple players, everybody has to get to that point level, because anyone who doesn't, the city gets one worse each time. So it bounces down. If it ever goes below zero on its kind of influence scale, the game's over. And then whoever you can win in that situation if you are above the threshold, but it's most likely that everyone's going to lose because you've been doing miserable. If you're above it, though, it goes up. So if I'm below and Kitty, you're above, but I'm below by three and you're above by two, the city goes down net one. If I'm a solo player and I'm below by five, the city goes down by five. But if I'm up by two, it goes up by two. So I'm just really trying to stay afloat as you're going through. And the way you do this is it's a worker placement game. So you're going to place workers on these different areas that do all kinds of different things. Mostly, you're going to be picking up... So your workers are called, I think they're foremen or managers. So you're placing your managers, which could recruit more workers, which could recruit businesses, which also could allow you to trade contracts with foreign people or local or on the black market. All of these things get you money, or they get you influence, and that influence is really what your target is. So it's this engine building machine in front of you. At the beginning, you're not really going to probably meet your victory point goal, but you want to make sure you're set up well enough so later on you can. As the city gets in worse areas at the beginning of each round, something bad is going to happen. And even if you're in a good zone, something bad is going to happen. There's always something bad happening that you're trying to kind of balance out. I really, really enjoyed this game. And I'm looking forward to the expansion now. I'm also looking forward to introducing more people to it, because even though it looked really complicated, it's like a lot of Euro games is once you understand the iconography, which is our topic today, you understand the game and it's just easy to play. So that is Crysis. Check it out. They do have late backing right now. So if you go to the Crysis Kickstarter page, you can click on late pledge or something like that to actually back this game right now. So, and there's plenty of reviews and how to plays on there. Like I said, it's been out for about a year. All right, that's enough of me. Let's see if Josh is still around and let's do some feedback.
Indeed. Well, let's get some feedback about past episodes. And if you have feedback about this or any of our previous episodes, email us at podcast@tabletopgametalk.com or go to our Board Game Geek forums, easily found at tabletopgametalk.com/BGG. The first is from Trevor and Christina Davis about Next Level Games. They say, along with the Wirecutter article feedback, I must say you guys are spot on when you say someone needs to be guided past the gateway games. They are really a door to nowhere rather than a gateway to the hobby. We have played them, Catan, Ticket to Ride, Risk, Werewolf, etc., quite a bit in the last several years with our oversized family, 7 kids from 16 to 3. How we ended up getting past them is due actually to Pokemon. My 9-year-old loves Pokemon, but I won't let him play video games. He's stuck with the cards. Keeping it interesting for him is my counter to that. So we seek out Pokemon groups to go play and trade with. We went to a game store on Pokemon Day just to check it out a couple of months ago. Two guys who worked there spent over an hour guiding my 12 and 13-year-olds through Star Wars Legion. They absolutely loved it. That opened us up to playing D&D, which I last played over 25 years ago, after two core sets of Legion and a D&D starter set. I'm amazed when I imagine how much money Chris has invested in his game closet. Very true. As we journey into the hobby, I'm enjoying all y'all's podcast and guidance. North Carolina, remember? My list of games to try with the clan keeps growing. We've moved from one game night a week to about 5. It's been a real joy for all of us.
Yeah, I actually think that this is probably a common thing. It's not so much that people aren't ready to go to the next step of games. It's that you, people don't know that there is a next step of games. And I think a lot of hobbies, or actually just a lot of things out there are like that. You know, you find out, I'm going to use Sydney's running club. You know, she moved to Grays Lake and suddenly she found that there was a running club here. And then when she joined that, it like totally changed like her weekend hobbies. You know, she hangs out with these guys all the time. And without looking out and reaching out for that, you would have never known that was there. And I think, you know, board game hobbies are kind of the same way. It's like, okay, I can go to Target, but that's the only place I go. I'm limited to a very specific set of games. And until I have to go someplace else, or, you know, think to go someplace else, you don't even know that you could go there.
That's true.
Which is kind of the point I felt like I was trying to make. And I think maybe it got misconstrued by some people, but I'm so glad that Trevor and Christina made it better for me.
All right, your turn, Kitty.
Some more feedback here from Robert McMillan. I just finished your Play for Fun episode and have a bit of feedback. I think the point was not discussed was the importance of playing for fun for the benefit of the other players at the table. If I'm teaching a game to new players, but I'm a veteran and know some good strategies to win, I don't necessarily want to beat the pants off those players. Not only would that not be fun for them, but I really don't think it would be fun for me either. I could make the strategies known to the players before the game, but I think it takes a bit of the fun of discovery and the aha moments away from those players. I like to take these opportunities to try out new strategies for myself, especially in games I've played over and over and over again. I'm not pulling my punches or purposely trying to lose, but rather trying to figure out new methods of playing the game. Sometimes I win and sometimes I lose, but ultimately I think it helps everyone at the table have fun.
Yeah, I don't think I could agree more with this. And I think this is my tendency too, especially when learning a new game with somebody or with anybody, or teaching a game I know to somebody. I try not to play overly aggressive, especially if it's one of those things that is where you being competitive is an advantage. So something like Rising Sun. If you've played Rising Sun once and you're playing with someone new, you're going to win that game because there's just so many things going on there that you can't capture on the first playthrough. But what I think is interesting is something like Splendor. Everybody has a pretty much an equal playing field when you start that game. You kind of get the hang of it right away. There's enough luck to mitigate and you can just have fun with that, where that's almost like I like playing Splendor with newer people just because I can play the way I want to play and I don't have to worry about like just blowing someone else out of the water because I'm so much better than they are. Sometimes it still happens because someone doesn't grasp it, but there's still that luck factor that helps, you know, kind of even the playing field. So
yeah, I felt a little bit like you wrote this email yourself, Chris.
I didn't, although I might from now on. So Robert, I'm just going to take over your email address and write all of your emails in the future. All right. I also got a comment from Trevor on BGG. He's like, has anyone ever seen a psychological or sociological study where types of games preferred are linked to personality types? It'd be interesting to compare the MBTI results or some similar personality test to gaming preferences and see if there's a general linkage there. I would love to participate and or sponsor and or like do this study.
Oh my God. Yeah. I mean, I think definitely, you know, social deduction games like Werewolf, I feel like there's a personality type there. There's got to be some dimensions of your personality that makes you enjoy that.
Well, I think this is a great marketing tactic too. I mean, if you know the types of people you're catering to, and all right, so imagine like miniatures games where you're actually, you know, all of the strategy involved in it, measuring things out, you know, you love the dice rolling, you love all that. If you knew that the personality type that liked those games was, you know, 5% of the population, which I think sometimes you get a gut feeling for what games are going to sell and not sell. But if you know who you're catering for, you can just like focus cater for that group and say, okay, this is what I'm going to make. This is that. But now I'm going to make a game that the other 80% of the population is really going to like, because 15% of the population doesn't like anything. We all know that. So, okay. Let's see. I have two quick questions to choose from, one in the show notes and one that was this just in. And we're going to try this just in one. Quick question.
Exciting.
Can it? This is not in the show notes, so you guys, I'm putting you on the spot.
I can't read it.
I know. So actually, I'll read Kitty's thing. Let's see. This is a quick question. One of our listeners has a question that won't fill an entire episode or topic, but we think it's interesting nonetheless. Today's question comes from Sydney via text, literally as we're recording, and she knows I'm recording. Okay, here it is. Quick question. Can it be beneficial to have an alpha player, an analysis paralysis player, an emotional player, playing with table issues, etc., at the table? Does an alpha player help keep the game moving, and an analysis paralysis player give people more time to chill and chat in a friendlier setting? I know you're actually, she continues with, I know you're probably recording, but I had this idea and I just wanted to get it out to you.
That's interesting.
This is real time stuff happening here.
It's crazy. And I think she got a point. I mean, like, definitely, I love the fact that she's saying that the analysis paralysis player, gives everyone else a nice time to chat and talk. And, you know, like I've said before, the analysis paralysis player only needs to be like 1 minute longer than everyone else. And after a few turns, that's like, you know, elongated to a bunch more longer time because of the kind of lag of that. But yeah, I think that's a great point. And it's definitely, we have made up those three elements of those players between us, I think. You know, correct me if I'm wrong.
I think that it is a great point. I think I'm trying to think that when you are thinking, and Kitty and I are there, we're typically not talking about something outside the game. We're not socializing. We're trying to be quiet and patient to let you think. And then if we throw in an alpha player into the mix, so now we have our AP player who's thinking, you have the alpha player who knows how everything should go, and then you have the two social players that are just trying to be quiet so that the alpha player and the analysis paralysis player don't kill each other. Yeah, I'm not sure this is beneficial.
But well, I like the fact that the alpha player is probably you, who knows so much about games that you teach us games every time. I mean, that certainly helps. I don't necessarily think the AP player is killing the game, but I'm coming from my point of view, which is the AP player. So, of course, I'm going to think that.
I think this would be an interesting game to watch.
So I think this is how we play every week. I think you just don't see it necessarily, Chris. So because I do think that Josh taking his time gives us time to figure out what we're going to do on our turns for most games, unless something drastically changes by the time it gets around to us. Usually, you know, it gives us time to think. And then we do have, we have conversations a little bit on the side. And then I'm the more emotional player. So I keep us all like engaged in the game because like I'm in it. I'm excited about it. I'm paying attention to what's going on. So, if there's no one to do that, then the game can totally just get like off track. Nobody like comes back to it. Because I think the alpha player sometimes can get to just like, I'm over this, you know, like they lose their patience more quickly than other players.
Maybe. Well, I also definitely think that there should be a pause. Well, there should not be a pause in the game concentration. If someone's taking a longer time, and it doesn't have to be an AP player, if somebody's just taking longer time and other people find that this is time to get up, go get a snack, go to the bathroom, they're basically doing something different where they're not being engaged in the game. It's a really fast way for a game to sort of fall apart because now no one's really fully invested in it. And even that person who's like taking the time to be invested in it, their interest in being invested in it becomes less as other people's are. Now, there are certainly exceptions. If there's, you know, 20 minutes of downtime between your turn and you don't have to do anything, these are exceptions to that. But for things that are meant to be a little bit more interactive and, you know, they're supposed to be going around pretty quickly, I think it can be detrimental to have, you know, people kind of occupy themselves while one person thinks and the other person is scheming or something like that. But it's an interesting thing to think about. All right. Should we go on topic?
We shall.
Sure.
All right. And let's press this button.
Interesting. In this episode, we're talking about the iconography and components in our games. These things should fade into the background because they just feel right, or better yet, they should give us a sense of, wow, that's cool. But sometimes they do the opposite and make an otherwise good game unapproachable.
Yeah, so we did this episode 37. We did an episode called Tricking Out Your Games, where we took at components and said, okay, what can we do with our components that make them super cool? We're going to talk a little bit about components, but I really want to focus on the iconography of games. We'll talk about components where components really add or detract from the play in the same way iconography can. But I don't want to... Components by themselves, like if we talk about Cool Mini or not, and like look at all the different miniatures and stuff, and is that really necessary, and those types of things, they aren't really. But there are certain components that are really key, and then there's other components that really just like almost detract from the game. So we'll get there a little bit. Do you guys have any feelings on this out of the box, though? Like, is there a game where you're like, I really like this game, but the iconography, just I couldn't get it for this reason, or it was off-putting. I just couldn't get into it because of the, you know, the design of the game itself.
I think the obvious choice is Terraforming Mars. It's so hard to figure everything. Like, I feel like there's 900 symbols and they all look too similar or something. And all of the colors, like, I don't know. I still, like, I can't remember it well enough to talk about it because it's also confusing.
So I did, for those who follow us on Board Game Geek, I took Terraforming Mars off the list of games that you guys could complain about, only because I wanted to save it for us. So we might as well start there. It's a great place to start. Terraforming Mars, to many, 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 many people, is an amazing game. And to me, it's a good game. I wouldn't put in the amazing category, even with the issues we're about to talk about. But so if you love Terraforming Mars, you can certainly send us emails at feedback@tabletopgametalk.com and let me know how we're wrong on this. But I'm going to point out a few things that Kitty was talking about. The cards themselves are fine. They're not the greatest quality. They're kind of a thin cardboard. There's no treatment on them. If you want to play it as often as many people do, you're going to have to sleeve them, or they are going to fall apart as you shuffle them. And you shuffle the cards in this game a lot. There's also like a stack of them, which makes shuffling them kind of complicated. The cards in the upper left corner have a number. And that number is how much it costs you to essentially buy that card, not play that card. So when you're trying to put cards into your hand, that upper left corner matters. Once it's in your hand, the upper left corner doesn't matter, which is counterintuitive because any other card game you might play, you're spreading your cards out so that you can see the upper left corner in your hand, where that number is the least important thing on the card when it's in your hand. That's number one. Number two, the upper right corner has any number of symbols from 1 to, I think, 3 or 4 is probably the max. Some of these symbols are mechanical in nature. They let you know when you can play it or if it's an instant thing or something like that. Others are a cost modifier. Others still have no bearing whatsoever unless you have another card in your hand that references that particular symbol. But if you're learning the game and you're looking at the upper right of your card, which means you have to fan it backwards if you want to see that, because they do matter when they're in your hand, you can't actually, like, you don't know which ones are important or why. You're like, well, I have this little thing that looks like a moon. What does that mean? I don't know. Nobody knows. There's no place in the rules that tells you what this icon is. There's just a card someplace that references, if you have this symbol, you're going to get more points. Like, okay, then why does it have the same equal weighting as the other symbols, like the little black star, which stands for some kind of metal, or the arrow icon, which stands for when you can play it or what it does? The weight of these symbols, it just, they're too equal and they don't make a whole lot of sense. Now, let's add another thing, and I hate banging on Terraforming Mars like this because people really do love it, and it's not terrible, it's just... it's really confusing when you're trying to play it. If you have a little purple lightning bolt, that means you have energy. If there's a brown, looks like dirt patch around the purple lightning bolt, it means that that is the production value of that energy. It's very difficult. it's like, wait, what does it mean again when there's brown? Is it, how does this work again? What am I changing?
It's that kills me.
Yeah, there's a lot of things on these cars. And then once you get used to it, once you play it a few times, you're like, okay, I get what you're trying to do here. I think what Terraforming Mars was trying to do was a little bit of what Race for the Galaxy was doing, where you take the iconography and make it its own language. The problem with it is Terraforming Mars also has a ton of words on it. Where Race for the Galaxy, that language is pretty much the only language you need to know, which makes it language independent, especially for a Euro game. That's a very common thing to see, is a symbolic language that you don't have to, they don't have to translate into 15 different languages. Terraforming Mars still has a ton of text, still has all the icons. Now, granted, most of the time the text is explaining the icons when it's in the card area, which helps a lot, but it doesn't, you know, you don't need all this extra iconography and the text on there and all of that at the same time. It's a little messy. It doesn't detract from the game being great. It just detracts from people trying to, you know, grok it and learn it.
Well, yeah. I mean, the other thing is like, I mean, it's something that like a lot of board games can suffer from, this kind of stereotype where, and they make fun of this in the comedy with Leslie Knope. It's called
Parks Help Me and Out, Recreation. Kitty.
That's it. And they have this game called The Cones of Dunshire that one of the main characters makes up. And there's just so much stuff on the board. There's cones everywhere. There's icons. There's little miniatures. There's counters. There's little, beads and things. And it's just like, oh yeah, the classic board game where there's like a million things on the board and I can't work out where I'm meant to look. And I mean, I guess it's a certain type of genre that suffers from this more than most. I mean, Euros tend to be this way, with the sort of point salads and things to look at everywhere. But it doesn't help, you know, especially if you're new to that style of game. You're kind of like, and even for me, who've played tons of Euros, like, I'm like, where am I putting my attention? There's some, on Terraforming Mars, there's some temperature track, there's an oxygen track, there's something about awards, there's something about milestones, there's a weird other thing in the bottom right that I don't even know what that is. And it's really hard to keep track of these things when you just throw a ton of stuff out there. I mean, some people love it, but I find it very distracting.
Yeah, well, I mean, there's icons just for the sake of having icons. You know, you talk about the awards and the milestones. It's like, why do those even have any kind of icons with them? You know, it's just, there's just, it's icon overload is really what it is.
Right.
And some of them are useful. Don't get me wrong. I think some of them are very useful. I just... using them in the right way would make the game much easier to understand for players. Another game that actually learned from this, so Thunderstone Quest has just recently come out. It's the third iteration of that game. The first game version was Thunderstone. Then there was Thunderstone Advanced. Now there's Thunderstone Quest. Thunderstone had some pretty terrible iconography. And, you know, just the way the cards are laid out, you know, a friend of mine at the time, he's like, it's a really great game. The iconography is horrendous, and I won't play it because of that. Thunderstone Advanced came out, and his response was, they fixed the iconography, now it's the game it should have been, and it's actually playable. And then Thunderstone Quest came out, and they even cleaned it up even more by removing some extra rules that just weren't necessary, and adding more streamlining to the icons and made it simpler. So not every game, though, benefits from this. They can't just kind of release new versions every couple years and be able to get away with that. Thunderstone Quest barely got away with it, but it has enough of a following where they were able to get a pretty successful Kickstarter for the third iteration. I don't know. I know for Terraforming Mars, we will see a deluxe version. I don't know if that means they're going to update the card layouts and iconography. Probably not significantly if they are. Maybe they... you know, do a pass at the art. But again, I don't think so. I think really the deluxe version is just going to be higher quality components as opposed to trying to fix any other issues with the iconography. Because I actually haven't heard a lot of complaints with people complaining about Terraforming Mars iconography. It's mostly the quality of the components, but...
yeah. I was going to say, you know, the weird thing about Terraforming Mars is I feel like it's so popular, no one cares.
Yeah.
Like, it's a fun enough game as is that everyone's like, eh, well, you know, it, it might take you a few games to figure out the iconography, but once you do, it's a fun game to play. I just feel like I've never maybe gotten over that hurdle of playing it enough.
Yeah, and for me, it doesn't, like, the game is good to me. It is not a game that I'm compelled to go back to keep playing. Like, the board itself is kind of blah, this brownish color. You have a lot of these green tiles that, you know, you're putting all over the place. It's what you're doing is interesting, and I enjoy playing the game, but it just doesn't draw me back to it. And a lot of that has to do with just the components and the cards themselves. And I'm not overly interested in optimizing my strategy for the game, because when I'm playing it, I don't feel, I don't know. It just doesn't have that wow factor to me. And that's because I'm shallow, I guess.
No, I think a lot of people are like that. And something like Scythe, at least, is the opposite for me anyway. I look at it and I'm like, wow, yeah, I'm so excited to play this game because of like the art, the iconography, and all the components.
Yep. Well, and that's a great example on the extreme other side, right? Because Scythe has everything that's on there has very bold meaning. And there's still a decent number of icons there. But they're so different and they're used only where they need to be, where you understand exactly what this is and how they relate to each other. You know, you're the, even just the resources by themselves, especially if you get the upgrade pack, you know, they feel like they're actually those items, those resources. And you know, it's like, oh, that's wood right there. That's oil over there. And it's just very clear. And I think that that's one of the reasons why Scythe's awesome. Plus it has mechs, you know, you have all these little cool little plastic mechs, the boards themselves. You know, if you can compare the Terraforming Mars player mat with the Scythe player mats, there's no comparison to that. You know, you have these two-dimensional boards on Scythe that have all your little bits fit in there, where Terraforming Mars, if someone bumps the table, the game's invalid because now everything that was marking all of your different areas on your mat are, you know, all shifted around. Like, I don't know if I have a 7 in income or a 2 income anymore because I wasn't paying attention or whatever the case is. Let's talk quickly about Race and Roll for the Galaxy, because I don't know. Kitty, did I make you play? I made you play Roll for the Galaxy at one point, right?
You sure did.
And Josh, have you played Roll for the Galaxy?
I think I might have done. I'm going to pull up a picture and then I'll let you know.
So Race and Roll are, well, Race for the Galaxy, I think, is the poster child for that iconographic language, where there's no text on the cards. It's just, here's all the icons, and you can read them and understand what you need to do. Roll for the Galaxy kind of pulls that back a little bit. There's just less icons. And one of the things, reasons I think that they do this for Race and, well, Roll, just because it's part of Race, is back to what I was saying, where if you have a language that is essentially you made up, it's just all these icons, you can have mass appeal for this in lots of different languages. And for heavy Euro games, such as Race for the Galaxy, that's really kind of what they were going for. Now, this goes so over the top because there's so many different things you can do. I'm not even sure. I mean, it's definitely icon overload where it is very off-putting to new players. But at the same time, I'm not sure it was a bad move for them because it is one of the most talked about games at the very least. And now they have a game called Jump Drive, which is a kind of a Race for the Galaxy Junior, which you can get into and it plays in like 20 minutes. And the iconography is very easy to see and get, you know, figure out. So this is another one of those games where it was able to, over three versions, Race, Roll, and now Jump Drive, really kind of refine those icons and what they needed to do. But I don't know, Kitty, I'm curious, is like when you first started playing this, was it the icons really a problem, or did you like, okay, yeah, I kind of get this. This makes sense.
I feel like it sort of made sense, but it took a little while. It is very much like learning a language. It takes you a little bit, but then once you get it, you're like, oh, okay, this is what this means. It's very clear, but it's not easy for me to, once again, like, kind of grok the game. It's a little harder to pick up than if the language is spelled out right there. It's, but once you got it, you got it.
Yeah. Well, and a side effect to this is once you know the language, expansions and such, you know, you just immediately understand what this card is doing or what it says because you now know that language. Except for with Roll for the Galaxy, every expansion introduced a new word or phrase into the language, but it's still relatively easy to just incorporate it into what you're doing. All right. Someone asked me about Mage Wars in email, and I should have... Well, wait. I have it here someplace. Joe did. Joe Rexdad asked me about Mage Wars. We did an unboxing of Gloomhaven, and he saw my Mage Wars shirt and asked me about it. So Mage Wars, I've never made anyone play outside of the playtesting period for it. Mage Wars is a great game. It is essentially a tactical miniatures game, but with all with cards. And the way this game works is you have a binder of cards. It's kind of like Codex in that you have a binder of cards and you're going to pick two of those cards every turn that you're going to add to your hand and you're going to be able to play those cards. Now, these cards become creatures on the map and you can move them around. So it's this 4x4 grid. And depending on the rules and whatnot, they're going to move around and do different things. The card iconography. So I'm actually credited as a playtester, lead playtester, and assistant designer on this game. And while this game was in playtest, there were a few things that I thought were placeholder assets. So much so that I almost didn't mention anything about them until I saw that nothing was changing in these. I'm like, oh, when are you going to do the final icon for the life and for like the hidden and unhidden? It's like, no, those are the final icons. I'm like, oh, okay. So... the life on the cards themselves, the art is fantastic. Even the framing isn't terrible. The icons, some of the icons are just, they just stick out at, like sore thumbs. So it's a very cartoony feel in general. Not cartoony, but high fantasy art feel. And Magic the Gathering in a lot of cases. So those types of icons tend to be more design, like graphic design-ish versus realistic. But for their hidden icon, they have a picture of someone's eye that is closed. So it's a close-up on an eye that's closed. And for revealed, it's a picture of someone's eye that is open. And that has always just creeped me out to have this kind of realistic eye staring at me. The life, you know, most people, most games use a little Valentine heart symbol for a life counter. No, this is an actual human heart that they use as a life symbol. These icons are so off-putting to me that I have a hard time like taking the game seriously because it just looks like this art was left over from placeholder stuff. And it's so
That's
sad
funny,
because
I just kind of think that it's like a bit of subjectivity creeping in here. Because I mean, some people, they love that kind of dark, kind of gritty, almost like horror-esque. I mean, I'm looking at the cards now. I can see what you're talking about. I mean, the only issue I seem to have is I can see about 10 different little icons clustered all around the edge of the picture of whatever card it is. And I'm finding that confusing. You know, it's just like, wow, there's a lot of little icons here. I don't know where I should be looking.
Yeah, so let's go on to a couple of the other icons. You have an hourglass that tells you that it's a slow spell. You have a lightning bolt that tells you that it's a fast spell. You have ranges. So there's this icon that has basically its crosshairs with two numbers in it. And for close range, it says 0-0, which also could be looked at as like a pair of eyeglasses, I guess. It's kind of hard to tell what it is. But it might say 1-2 if it's, you know, 1-2 zones away. You have these combat lines that will have either an hourglass or a lightning bolt, which tells you how fast it is. Then it has a symbol for the type of attack it is, whether it's a red sword or a green bow, or there's a couple other ones. Then you have some other symbols that could represent like an effect. It's like a poison or a burn or something. And then you have a red square, which is the number of dice you're going to roll. Then you have another die, which is, it tells you that you're going to roll, either you're going to roll a d12 or not, and it's going to give some kind of other effect, which then throws that in there as well. And this could appear up to 3 times on a card, that these kind of hieroglyphic lines show up on the card. Once you understand that, you can read it and you can kind of get a feel for it. You know what it is, and it becomes something that's relatively easy to understand. But at the beginning, there's just icon overload. To add to it, and this is outside of the icons, there's something in the neighborhood of 30 different keywords that all have different things. And depending on the card, you could have multiple numbers of these things. And something as simple as, you know, one of the keywords, one of the very first ones in the glossary is Aegis with an X. I think it's Aegis. It might be Aegis, A-E-G-I-S. It's basically shield. That's what it is, right? And Aegis is a Greek name or some kind of name for shield. If you look it up, that's what it is. It's a synonym. And I'm like, well, why don't you just call it Shield 2 as opposed to Aegis 2? Like, everyone knows what a shield is. And it's like, no. This is, you know, this comes from this term over here and this is that. I'm like, okay, fine. I understand where it comes from. It doesn't mean it's clear. And when you have 20 or 30 different unique vocabulary words, it makes it really hard to get into this game, which is why I've never taught it to anyone. I've played it many times. I played it with other people who wanted to learn it. And I would never put this on the table to any of my gaming friends outside of the gaming, like, hardcore tactical hobby, and call this something that you should get into.
You're making it sound as bad as Yu-Gi-Oh!
It is way better than Yu-Gi-Oh!
I do feel like you're playing right into Michael's rant that he posted, where he talks about he demos games, and a lot of games, when he's being teaching them, they ask him to use game-specific names for tasks. And he says, I understand branding and wanting to stay on task, but when you use meeples, for example, don't call them warrior pawns and then expect people to dig through the box looking for their missing pieces, because everyone knows they're called meeples.
Right.
So the language can be just as infuriating as the iconography.
Yeah. Well, and he also goes into, like, the language of tapping a card. And so tapping is a magic trademarked word. So Wizard of the Coast has trademarked that word. You can't use it. In casual play, everyone refers to turning a card sideways as tapping. In most board games, they will use the terms exhaust and unexhaust as the generic phrase for it, except for some board games who try to come up with their own words to mean something else. And then it's like, wait, what are you trying to tell me? Oh, that's just tapping. And what he's getting to here is, when he's demoing games, he has to use the correct terminology based on the game he's demoing, because that's what the publisher wants them to use for branding. And it's really tough. That's why I always refer to, like, anything where you can buy stuff with it, it's just monies. It doesn't matter what the game calls it. I refer to it as monies. It's this many monies. And monies is not pluralized, and that's why it makes sense to me. I think Caleb actually mentioned Adrenaline was a good game with iconography. Adrenaline is a very family-friendly game where the iconography isn't spectacular because there's a lot of it, but there's most of the rule book is just kind of taking every single card and explaining what it does. And once you've seen the same card a couple times, you're like, oh, I understand what that is. So I think the way they teach you that language works really, really well for that. Steven actually calls out card quality as a problem in a lot of games. And I think, like, I've actually heard designers say, it's like, well, we're not really that concerned about the cards because we know everyone's going to sleeve them anyway. I'm like, don't make that assumption. Just make good cards. Some people don't like sleeving their cards. Let's see. Yes.
I have one game I want to talk about. Concept.
Yes.
So this game is all icons, all icons. It's all that it is. And you're trying to get people to guess a concept by placing tokens on the icons. And I kind of love this game, but I have a hard time finding people who want to play with me.
Well, it just sort of depends, right? Because it's a very casual game. This is one of those games that falls really well into last week, where playing for fun. Like, when you play Concept, have you ever played it and actually kept score?
No, never.
And the interesting thing about Concept is the abstract nature of it is you're trying to get across this concept, and the icons themselves don't actually have to mean what they are supposed to mean in the book, right? It's like, okay, this is a circle with an X through it. I'm just trying to get across the fact that you know, you're not allowed to play volleyball here or something. I don't know. I'm totally pulling that out of nowhere. But why do you think that you can't get people to play it?
I think it has something to do with maybe like wavelengths, because it's all how you see the icons and what they mean to you. Like, you have to kind of be in the same like thought space as somebody else. And it gets very frustrating very fast if somebody is just like not picking up what you're putting down at all. And I feel like you really have to have the right kind of environment and the right crowd to get it to the table, because I do think it gets incredibly frustrating for the clue giver incredibly fast.
Yeah. Well, actually, this goes back to the whole iconography thing in the first place, right? Because what's happening here is you're trying to use one language and someone else is intuiting a different language from what they're seeing. And when you look at games that have a lot of icons in there, if the designer is trying to use one language, but the people who are trying to understand that those icons are seeing different things, it becomes a mismatch. Like, concept is kind of a representation of when iconography goes overboard.
Yeah.
Although it's still a great game. It's a great party game. Don't keep score.
It's so much
fun. It's really what it comes down to. Let's see. I think Michael had another mention. He mentions Thief's Market, which is a game he absolutely loves. But all the iconography on the cards, you have to sit there with a translator card to play effectively. On top of that, sometimes the meanings provided are hard to understand. That's probably why, despite my liking the game very much, it only gets played once every few months. And I think that really that last part is the most, it's a perpetuating cycle, right? If you have a game with a lot of iconography and that puts you off from playing it on a regular basis, you have to relearn that every single time you play the game. Where people who play Race for the Galaxy all the time, they don't think about the iconography anymore. They're just like, no, this is super easy. This is just how this all works. Because they just understand it, because they know that language and they're fluent in it. So I think it's interesting that this, it can have a self-perpetuating thing. It's the reason I don't play Mage Knights, right? Is because it's the iconography and all the keywords and all of the stuff that goes into understanding that game has such a huge learning curve that I can't teach it to people. And that's frustrating to teach some people. So, by the way, Mage Wars is great. Also love the company. I love Arcane Wonders. They have a Mage Knight Arena, which is a simplified version of Mage Wars. They have a simplified version called Mage Wars Arena, I believe. So if you want to get into Mage Wars, you think that idea sounds cool, check out the Arena version. All right. Do we have anything else to add to this? Because I know this is mostly just me ranting, but I had to do it. I had to get it out of my system.
Oh, good.
I think I'm set.
All right. Well, you can follow us on Facebook at Tabletop Game Talk Podcast. You can follow us at Twitter at Tabletop Game TLK. You can follow me at Game Master Chris. We love iTunes reviews. And if you want to support us via Patreon, you can go to tabletopgametalk.com/Patreon. That will get you entered into all of our contests for free. You can also email us and get additional, well, you enter for free anyway, automatically entered without emailing us. But if you do email us, you get bonus entries as well. With that, I'm going to let Josh do some more talking.
Indeed, Tabletop Game Talk is a proud member of the Dice Tower Network. Thanks for listening, and remember, we love your feedback. So email us with comments or questions at podcast@tabletopgametalk.com. Finally, a huge thank you to our patrons, Emil Giljam, George, Adam Harrison, Gory Bell, Sam from New York, Jason Strong, Terence Miltner, Stephen Seitz, Michael Ohl, Trevor Olson, Brian Arnold, Sean P. Kelly, Daniel Shepherd, C. Marie, Rudy Liu, Benjamin Heimowitz, Jerry Huang, Stefan, I couldn't think of a quote quick enough, Phillips, Caleb O'Brien, Jennifer Engelbrecht, Justin Willard, Christopher Dong, Jason Marks, Jeremy Fisher, Carl Hammond, David Radke, Lance Morgan, Nick Quickstra, David Sellers, Jason Rodney, Michael Yanikowski, Miles Clark, Cindy Lum, Phil Swartzwell, Jordan Livingston, Greg Kamai, Zoe Ng, Chad Covey, Anne Reynolds, Eric Huffman, Adriana Dong, Christopher Vincent, Nate, Faz Flintham, Sean Peck, Toby Kraft, Eric Salander, Adam Kriblez, and Mike Smith. Until next week, when we talk about social contracts in board gaming, keep playing games and having fun.
Good night. I think I could just keep going on and on and on and on and on about iconography that I don't like.
Oh, I know. You love it. You really love it.
Well, now I have so many games. So I went to the, looked to my shelf. I'm like, all right, which games do I want to talk about on today's thing? It's like, oh, you know, most of these, I just kind of get rid of them when I don't like the iconography. And then I just put other games in their place.